nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
And I think if you were here, then you remember I kind of talked about first the electronic band structure lab that was based on the tight binding model, and it's available in NanoHub. Effectively what this is doing is using like NeMo 5 as a backend to do band structure calculations for like 1D, 2D, and 3D nanoscale systems, right? So like nanowires and ultra-thin bodies, and then just like 3D periodic lattices, like bulk materials like silicon, germanium, and then I think it does gallium arsenide and indium arsenide as well, if I remember right. And then I just kind of walked you through like all of the kind of key aspects of this program, like, you know, like how you control the input, what the knobs you can turn are basically, and then how to interpret the output and then compare it to like the well-known literature results. And then I talked about an alternative to kind of the previous calculational methods called density functional theory. And then we talked about quantum espresso. That's like a NanoHub implementation of the DFT algorithm, and then kind of talked about the accuracy of that. And I guess the point about DFT we made was that it's not necessarily as accurate in certain situations as tight binding, but it has more general applicability. So in that sense, it could be very powerful. Although the NanoHub interface doesn't fully show the potential of this approach because only has one built-in example. So that's a little unfortunate. But today we're going to talk about two other tools also available in NanoHub. And then the first one is called the Periodic Potential Lab. And in fact, in retrospect, I would have liked to have presented this first because this is actually like kind of setting the stage for some of the more detailed calculations that come later. And then another one that we're going to talk about today is called CMT bands. And this is actually a very cool tool, in my opinion, because it deals with carbon nanotubes and graphene, and then graphene ribbons. And this is actually a very hot topic in research now. So we'll kind of get an appreciation for that as well. So basically, what is the Periodic Potential Lab doing? So this kind of goes back to something that we talked about like maybe in lecture 20, and then even before that, like with the Kronig-Penny model. So if you recall, basically like the diagram in the upper left, which has kind of like that raised potential, and then the well, and then another raised potential represents like kind of a series of quantum wells, right? And then the point is that if we write down the Schrödinger equation, and then we assume that we have periodicity, then we can write down a block form solution for that problem. And then we can just pretty much solve that Schrödinger problem directly in the case where the potential is like relatively straightforward, okay? And so the Periodic Potential Lab is just designed to deal with like a handful of like relatively canonical potential forms, okay? And to calculate like kind of all the key things that we were interested in, like the energy bands, like the band structure, but also look at the actual wave functions and like the spatial distribution of those wave functions, calculate the effective masses, which can be important for various like transport calculations, like in the drift diffusion model. And then of course the band gaps themselves comes directly from the band structure. And then that's the URL if you want to use it. So now I'm just going to kind of lay out like, you know, what do they mean by this like potential and what are the parameters that are key here? So the first thing that's important is kind of like both the minimum and maximum values of the potential. And so this carries over across all four types of potentials. So there's like a certain range. I mean, of course, Vmax should be greater than Vmin. And then there's this so-called energy over the barrier that basically tells you like how much energy does the electron have classically when it's in the region of Vmax. And so I think usually it's expected that it's like slightly greater than zero in this simulation, but it doesn't absolutely have to be in general, right? Because you can have like tunneling, right? And then like the geometric parameters are basically the period of the the whole well structure, whatever it is, which is called W, and then the barrier width, which is A. So this is actually different from the notation that I've seen more commonly in the literature, but this is just for the periodic potential lab. Okay. And then there's also a particle mass parameter, M naught, and that's in units of electron mass. Okay. Just to be clear. So you don't actually have to memorize the electron mass in kilograms and then plug it in there. Okay. So that's me. And then basically all these other things are basically just showing you the other wells that they do. And I guess the triangular well is kind of interesting just because it's asymmetric. So you see that like the left branch has a width A and then the right is like W minus A. So, you know, it can be very asymmetric in general. The parabolic well, on the other hand, is forced to be like precisely symmetric. So, the potential always minimum comes right in the middle. And then like, the left and right branches are mirror images of one another. So you don't set a separate A value. The Coulombic well, hopefully I'm saying that right, is basically probably like the closest to realistic form of potential, right? But, I mean, you could argue that there's like some degree of screening because there's still this like V minus V max, okay? And then the minus V max obviously is a finite value. So like, and like we said before, like in principle, if you have a point like charge, then actually minus V max would have to go to minus infinity, right? But then in practice, like, you know, you consider the nucleus to have a finite width. And so then as you get closer to the center, then the enclosed charge also goes to zero. So the potential doesn't blow up. So hopefully this makes sense so far. So what I can do now is kind of start up the NanoHub simulation, and then you can kind of see it firsthand. Let me make sure. Yeah, okay. This. Okay, here we go. Okay. So this is kind of shows you where you can enter all the kind of key parameters. So I think we'll just start with the step well because that's kind of the easiest thing to understand. And this is like a very kind of straightforward range of barrier height. And I'm going to like decrease the energy of the particle over the barrier to maybe like 0.5 eV. So that'll be a little more interesting. And then you can also change the period and the effective mass here. And so you can actually like pick some parameters from the literature, which is kind of nice. Like the heavy and light holes, I think, for silicon. And so then you can run it. It'll solve the Schrodinger equation, and it'll give you both the energy functional, let's see. So the reduced dispersion relation. So this is basically showing the band structure in 1D, right? So along this K along this direction. Okay. And so you see like there's a very large splitting, which is not surprising because that potential is very large compared to the energy of the electron. And then you can compare that to just the free electron, and you see that the free electron is lower because the effective mass is different and there's no band gap in the free electron, obviously. For the wave function here, you can see that you actually, depending on which mode you're in, will have a localized enhancement either like inside of these wells, right, for the low energy modes, or you'll have it outside of the wells for the higher energy modes. Okay, so that's like a key distinction there. And then if you look at this probability plot, it's probably easier to understand. That basically like the second band tends to be localized in these high energy states, like near the barriers. And then the other band tends to be localized in the low energy states. So does that make sense? Yeah.
Is the green curve scattering state?
So that's basically probability for the second band. So that's the high energy band. Like, so that's like a conduction band, essentially. And then the valence band is like the bottom one, like in red here. Right. So does that make sense? So it's just showing that there's like this dependent. I think this is not like an absolute value per se. Like, but this is like kind of shifted up by a certain amount to kind of make it more visible. But this is like kind of a very generic feature of like not just 1D band structures, but also higher dimensionalities, that when you have any kind of like splitting at a gap, like in nearly free electron theory, then you tend to have one mode that's low energy, that's localized in the low energy regions of the potential, and then vice versa, you have the other mode, which is orthogonal to that, and it's mainly localized in the high energy regions, right? So what's nice about this is as you kind of pick the different potentials, you can see how that changes the distribution. And another way to visualize this is the regions where it's above 50% probability. So you can see that it's above 50% probability in the high energy regions for that second band, and then all in the quantum wells above 50% for the first band, the red one. Right. So I think this is like the most straightforward to actually interpret, although it doesn't give you all the information. And then this is like kind of actually converting that band structure into density of states, because like before I think I showed you density of states, but I didn't really explain in great detail, like how do you get that? But this actually kind of makes it more obvious what's going on. And something you see specifically in the 1D band structure that you don't see in higher dimensionalities is this 1D Van Hove singularity, which is basically this 1 over square root divergence that's happening both at the bottom and the top of each of these bands. Okay, so the reason why this is significant is like when you have this like 1D divergence of the density of states, like at these certain critical values, these Van Hove singularity values, then this can have a big impact on the physics of the problem. So like in graphene or like carbon nanotube type materials, like you'll see like that they have substantially different physics than like bulk carbon, like a graphite, piece of graphite or, you know, diamond. I mean, it's like vastly different, as you probably are kind of dimly aware of, but like this kind of is one of the reasons that's coming from. And also, like, when you go up to, like, higher dimensionalities, you still do have Van Hove singularities at the top and bottom of these bands, but the shape is different. So usually, like, in 2D, it's going to be more like a jump discontinuity, but it has a finite distance, right? Like, it's not totally appreciable here because of the finite resolution of this calculation, but this would basically go to infinity in principle as you, like, got asymptotically close to this, the bottom of this band. But then there's always like a actual finite jump associated with these 2D Van Hove singularities. In 3D, actually, like the Van Hove singularities are much weaker. So that gives rise to like vastly different, physics near the band edges. And then, let's see, what else should I show you? I think, this allows you to kind of like download all the data as well, if you need. Oops. Let me do it again. Right. So whatever data you see that looks interesting, you can download it, and then you can kind of plot it on your own as well, which is nice. So I can download this. Like, so I can download everything. So this is really nice. And let me just go through like maybe a couple more if time permits. Where are we on time now? Okay. Okay. So parabolic potential. So as you can see, this is going to be a much sharper barrier. So when we look at the allowed band, so this is probably easier to look at. So you see that, you know, the band structure is actually pretty similar in this case. But then if you look at this probability distribution, or maybe above 50% distribution, you see that now the high energy band is actually a little more localized to this region, whereas before, I think, like, there wasn't, like, a great deal of a gap here. And then these are, like, strongly localized, like, at the bottom of the band. So I think there's a little more localization because it's, like, a sharper potential than you had before. If you go to, like, the Coulombic potential, then that should be even sharper than the first two, right? Because this goes, like, 1 over R. And so as long as, like, Vmax is relatively large, then you're going to see a big effect. And so if we look at this, so there's really nothing you can actually see here. That's interesting. So surprisingly enough, you don't actually see anything from that, the second graph I showed you. I think maybe we need to change this A value. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's the problem. So this should be more like 1 or something, right? Because, like, basically this is capturing, like a small nucleon, right? So, you know, something like smaller than a Bohr radius is probably appropriate for this kind of problem. So this should be maybe like 0.5A. So just give me a second to run this again. But now you should see like a much more dramatic difference. Right. So you can see like now there's a very large band gap right here. And then if we look at this like above 50% probability distribution, you see that the lowest energy state is going to be strongly localized right here. There's one state that's actually kind of like dispersed throughout the region. So this is kind of interesting because it looks like a nearly free electron. And then you have this third state that is actually strongly localized to the region between the nuclei, right? So that's like an antibonding state. So it's actually like kind of getting closer to some real physics, like in terms of it, like what would happen in actual materials, right? So this is obviously more appropriate for like a 1D crystal than like the 3D crystal, but it kind of gives you a very clear sense of like where the electrons are hanging out at the different bands. And I think that's helpful to kind of understand the relationship between the dispersion and the band gaps and the like spatial distribution of the electrons when you go to like more complicated systems, if you still have that intuition. So any questions about that so far? Okay. Great. So I can probably end this. So now if we go back here. Yeah, so this is kind of what I was showing you already. And so you can look at this in case you forgot what I just said. Okay, so now the second thing I'm going to talk about today is called CNT bands. And so what this is doing is kind of calculating a lot of the properties we were talking about before in previous discussions, but specifically for these two carbon-based systems of nanotubes and nanoribbons. And it can also help you calculating like the geometry and the chirality and some other properties. And I'm going to explain that in a minute, what that is. Right. So I'm not going to assume that you guys are experts in like kind of like nanostructured carbon materials. Okay. So what is graphene? First of all, if you haven't seen that before, like Andre Heim actually started this field by basically kind of considering the fact that like graphite is made out of many like sp2 hybridized carbon sheets. Right. So you might say like, okay, like, you know, graphite has certain properties. You can use it as pencil lead and so on. But what happens if you just extract one of these sheets? Okay. And so he came up with a very like interesting and, at first glance, very crude approach to extracting these carbon sheets, which was basically to take a piece of scotch tape and then put the tape on the graphite and then pull it off. And then he would pretty much like then at that point, put another piece of scotch tape and then pull apart these sheets. And then he kind of like keeps subdividing these sheets until you get to the point that you have just a single layer of carbon atoms. And this may sound like really far-fetched that that could actually work. And I'm pretty sure that if he told that, he was told most people that he was going to do that in advance, then they would have thought that he was crazy. However, it worked. And he was able to actually extract single layers of carbon sheets from graphite directly using this very, very simple technique, which doesn't require like a class one clean room, doesn't require like ultra sophisticated $1 million equipment, but just like basically stuff that every kid like in elementary school has access to, really. And so amazingly enough, nobody had thought of that or done that until he did it. And I mean, of course, he had some very sophisticated equipment to actually characterize it once he actually extracted it. But it was very revolutionary at that time. And eventually he did win the Nobel Prize for that work. So it did have a big impact. And now it's a very hot area of research. And I think like the last few years, like the amount of carbon nanostructure research, broadly speaking, in both graphene and carbon nanotubes has gone up really exponentially. And I'm pretty sure like about a quarter of all the PIs in Burke are probably working on it and probably a lot in other places as well. And to some extent, I mean, not necessarily that this is the only thing they care about, but I could give you like a long list of people that just are focused on this stuff. And so what it's showing on the left-hand side is basically the honeycomb lattice that's associated with graphene. Okay. And so you can kind of think about it as like, have you ever seen like a benzene ring? It's basically six carbon atoms, and then usually you draw it with a little circle around, right? So this basically indicates that you have like an sp2 hybridization, and you're effectively sharing 1.5 electrons from each carbon atom. And so you can represent it like this, like basically double carbon bonds, every other lattice edge, okay? But then it's also in resonance with another form, which looks kind of like this, okay? Where you basically have shifted all those extra electrons around, like by, I guess, 60 degrees, okay? And so the point is, rather than write it in these two resonant states and have to like write this every time you create a molecule, then you can just write it like this and kind of denotes the same concept of these resonating valence bonds. And so in some sense, you can think of what's happening with the graphene as kind of like you're creating a whole network of these benzene rings and then connecting them together, right? So if you're familiar with kind of the very elementary organic chemistry of benzene ring, then you can kind of just extend that to a large system. And so something that's very interesting about the physics of this system is that because the benzene has a delocalized set of electrons that are in these resonant alternating states, there's pretty good transport properties associated with this. So this is actually a very good conductor. And then another property that's very interesting is that despite its conductivity, it's also not good at absorbing, which is not necessarily obvious because most good conductors like silver are very non-transparent. So basically they reflect most of the incoming light. And that's because there's a strong connection between the dielectric function of a structure and the conductivity of the structure, right? Because basically you can represent in many cases that the permittivity epsilon would be like 1 plus I sigma over omega because of Ohm's law. Okay, so this is like a very like kind of unusual fact that you can simultaneously have good conductivity as well as relatively low absorption. And I think the reason for why you're able to break that usual connection is that it's so thin, right, just a single atomic layer, that the usual considerations of having reflection occur because of like the carriers is not present, because like there's just not enough material to cause that reflection, right? So as long as you're able to confine all your electrons within a single layer, then you can have very good transport. And another thing that's very interesting about the band structure of graphene is that it can usually be represented if you look at the K space and just like, let's say KX, okay, this is the X direction, then oftentimes you can represent the band structure as kind of like crossing like this. And so effectively what you have is something that's like a semi-metallic type state. And then if you look at KY, then it does the same thing again, right? If this is E versus KX, then E versus KY does the same thing. And so when you combine these two dispersion relationships, then you get what's called a Dirac cone. Okay, so what this means is that this Dirac cone basically means right at the Fermi energy, you have like a very unusual density of modes in the system. And so there is like a finite density mode, but then you can also actually gate these materials to shift the Fermi energy either up or down, right? So with a relatively small applied field, then you can shift that. And then some other things you can do are actually like if you like optically excite this thing, although like I said, it doesn't have a strong absorption, it has non-zero absorption. So if you get it to absorb enough photons, then you can actually create carriers and then have like a dynamic shift in the carrier concentration by orders of magnitude. So in some sense, it actually acts also like a semiconductor. So it's a very weird material in that sense, but that's also why people are interested in doing so much research on it. And then another thing you can do, if that's not enough, is actually you can take all of these elements of the graphene sheet and then roll them up. So if you think just very simply like that, this is our graphene sheet, then you can just roll it back on top of itself, right? And so you just create some sort of cylinder. And then that's usually called a carbon nanotube. And there are many types of carbon nanotubes. Like I think that this simulation tool is mainly geared towards single wall carbon nanotubes. So that's like the simplest structure you can make. But there are also so-called multi-wall carbon nanotubes where you might have like two or three concentric cylinders all made out of like these graphene type sheets. Yeah.
The Venn diagram looks like it doesn't have any band gap.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't really have a band gap. So, but it's actually kind of like a semi-metal in the sense that while there's no band gap, there is like a lower density of modes right at that Fermi energy, and then it picks up rapidly from either side. Right? So if you like drew the density of modes that's associated with it, then since it's like a 2D, then there's like kind of this finite jump, like right here or something. So in practice, although it looks like maybe you have a zero density modes, at any non-zero temperature, it'll be a pretty good conductor because you'll be shifting yourself off slightly from that Van Hove singularity. So, and then what happens also when you roll this up into a sheet with the carbon nanotube is that depending on how you roll it up into the sheet, it actually experiences different chirality. And so this diagram here is kind of showing you what happens with that carbon nanotube sheet, like basically three ways of rolling it up. This is just like a step-by-step process of cutting off a piece of that sheet and then kind of gradually curling it back around to itself until you get to that structure on the lower left-hand side, right? The one right here. And so what really matters is like kind of the difference between the number of periods that you have in the X and Y directions. And so you can denote that by two indices, M and N. Okay, so that's this pair right here. And for certain values of m minus n, I think if it's a multiple of 3, then I believe that it's metallic. And then if it's not a multiple of 3, then it's semiconducting. And so effectively what's happening is when m minus n has a mod value of 1 or 2, then that means that you have introduced a finite band gap into the structure. And so then you shift the band structure from something like this to something that looks more like this. Okay, so this is actually now more like a quote-unquote conventional material. And so this actually a very interesting property in its own right, like the kind of the distinction between these metallic and semiconducting states. So, I mean, one obvious question is, can you just, you know, pick one or the other? Like, just have a bunch of semiconducting carbon nanotubes or just, like, metallic ones, right? Now, there's been a lot of interest in kind of selecting out one or the other, but apparently it's pretty hard to do experimentally, and a lot of the times they would have to kind of go back after the fact and then sort out, like, which one has which properties. So there's some challenges that remain in terms of fabrication. And then the third kind of related a material system is called the graphene nanoribbon. And so here, instead of trying to roll everything up, you're actually just cutting it off of that graphene sheet and then kind of isolating it without rolling. Okay. And basically, you can define both a chirality and also like kind of the size dimensions, okay, for this structure, right? So the chirality basically depends on whether you're cutting the sheet like directly along the normal like lattice directions or if you're cutting that at orthogonal directions, right? So you can potentially cut it at a diagonal or something, right? So, but I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time talking about graphene nanoribbon specifically. So let me go back to here now. Okay. Is it here? No. Okay. Yeah, here it is. It's starting. Sorry. Oh, there we go. Just a little slow. Okay. So now you can kind of pick whether you want to work on graphene nanotubes or nanoribbons. Okay. So let's do nanotubes first. And then this gives you a choice for the types of simulations that you do. So I think the PZ orbital is probably a tight binding calculation based on the near combination of atomic orbitals. And then Huckel theory is kind of like a semi-classical approximation, right? So this actually kind of explains like the basis set that's used in both cases. So I think, yeah, this is like just a bigger LCAO. And then this allows you to define the chirality. And then, so what we expect to see, like I said before, is that if m minus n has certain values, then you'll get different band gaps that are associated with that. Okay, so then you can run this with m equal to n, right? So that's going to be like one key design parameter. So like I said before, we expected that this should be like a metallic structure. Because, okay, so that's just showing what it actually looks like, I think, right? So that's just the nanotube. You guys know what that looks like. But then importantly, here's the band structure that you get. And so this is what I was talking about, this region right here near the Fermi energy, where you can see that just in with Kx in 1D, that there's like this crossing. Without splitting, for like m minus n equal to zero. So this corresponds to metallic nanotube, right? So that's what you're seeing here. And then if we look at the density of states, you can see that the density of states is relatively low near the Fermi energy, but you don't see that final jump discontinuity to zero right at zero because it's just too small, right? So you can't really see that. But it definitely gets larger as you go away from the middle of the Fermi energy. And that kind of makes sense if you go back to here. That, like, there are clearly more bands like away from the Fermi energy, both above and below. Okay, so that suggests another density of states. Okay, so you get the idea. So now we want to basically change one of these chirality parameters. So now I'm going to just redo it with m minus n equal to 1. And then we'll see how that changes the whole structure. So this will just take a minute. So basically what it's going to do is hopefully show us that when m minus n equals 1, that it's actually a semiconductor. So it's going to have a finite band gap right near the Fermi energy. And so then that's going to give us, like, clearly a very distinct behavior. So, I mean, if you're thinking about using carbon nanotubes for various applications, then clearly you would like to have all the nanotubes have, like, kind of one type of material property or the other. But the fact that, like, basically the same raw material, like the same carbon atoms, can give rise to, like, multiple vastly different structures is very interesting. But it's not, like, totally impossible if you think about the difference between graphite and diamond, for example, right? So as you guys are aware, like, graphite is highly absorbing, very cheap, really abundant, and black. And then diamonds are kind of the opposite in every way, right? So they're very transparent. In fact, one of the best optical materials that money can buy. Insanely expensive. If anybody's been on the market to buy an engagement ring, you probably know firsthand how expensive they are. And it's very hard material, whereas graphite is very soft. So in every way, you would never guess naively that these materials had anything to do with each other. But in fact, it's just the same atoms arranged in a different way. So it's kind of amazing. Seems like this is getting stuck. Sorry about that. Let me see if I can reduce the size of this calculation a little bit. Maybe it's too aggressive to use the Huckel theory. Okay. We can just do the PZ orbital calculation. I think that will be a decent approximation. And we'll see if this converges in a reasonable time frame.
Maybe change the length.
Which length?
At the bottom.
I think that's just a visualization thing. I don't think it actually affects the computational time. I think. Last time I ran it, it was a little faster. Sorry about that.
You can try 6 and 5, not 5.
Why is that important?
I understand n should be greater than n. I'm not sure.
I mean, I can try it. Maybe it started the shutdown a week early. Yeah. Yeah. If they don't make it stop working, then it'll stop working next week. So. Okay. So I'm just going to restart it and see if that helps. We'll see. Okay, so if we do 6 and 5, oh, okay, so here, actually, maybe we should do 13 and 0. Maybe that would be faster. Okay, well, I'll let it run for a minute. Yeah, okay. Now it's going. Okay, so this is really hard to tell the difference from the previous thing just by looking at it. But clearly there's a big difference here in the band structure, right? Because now we have a band gap from about minus 0.4 up to plus 0.4, right? So now we've created actually a pretty substantial band gap of about 0.8 EV, which is close to that of germanium. Okay, a little smaller than silicon, but still very substantial band gap. And it's probably not obvious at all that just making that small change in the chirality would have caused the big band gap. But this actually will hold true, like I said, for all the M minus N that give you modulus value relative to 3 of 1 or 2, right? So 13 minus 0 mod 3 is going to be 1, right? So this should clearly be semiconducting. And then if we did 14, then we should get the same thing as well. So let me just do 14 to kind of illustrate that. And then if I remember correctly, the band gap should match each other. So there shouldn't be a change in the band gap size. It's just that it's kind of like almost a mirror reflection symmetry compared to the previous case. So if we go here, yeah, so again, this is from about 0.4 to minus 0.4, right? So same size of the band gap. But then if we went to 12, okay, just to show you that I'm not just like reusing the same simulation twice, I'm going to go to 12, and then we'll see if this becomes metallic like I predicted. All right, okay, so see, this is now metallic. And so this has no band gap anymore. And so it's actually a very interesting property. So if you're just growing like a field of these carbon nanotubes, usually like there's no mechanism to force the carbon nanotubes to grow in one way or the other. So pretty much like the relative chirality values are random. So then you usually get like 2/3 semiconducting and then 1/3 metallic. Okay. So then if you can figure out how to separate them accurately and quickly, then that by itself would be worth a ton of money. So you may want to think about that. And let me just quickly talk about the graphene nanoribbon. So you can see there are two types of graphene nanoribbons, and you can consider edge effects if you want. So I'm just going to do, I think, four by four or something. See if this can run in a reasonable time period. And then it'll both give you visualization as well as the band structure for that case. And like I said, we're neglecting edge effects. So once you start including edge effects, then it's going to change things a little bit. But you can see this is what the nanoribbon sheet looks like. So this is kind of like an unrolled carbon nanotube. Then you look at this band structure, you see this is like a metallic type structure. And the band structure is also different in the sense that these bands flatten out a lot, like close to this Brillouin zone boundary. So there's like also some key distinctions there. And then if, you know, we believe from before that like the chirality is really important, then maybe we'll actually see some different band gap if we use a different chirality, like 13 by 0. So we can try that real quick. I realize I'm running out of time here. Maybe I should let it run for a minute. Oops. Maybe I gave it too hard a problem. But yeah, this is just showing kind of like some of the band structures that are produced by this program. So, seems like it's getting stuck here. So what if we just did 7 by 0? Let me see if that's any faster. I mean, another thing I should probably mention is that, like, it actually lets you change these parameters here, the tight binding energy and carbon-carbon spacing, but usually I wouldn't recommend changing those. So anyway, so you can see that sometimes it's a little slow, but when it's working correctly, then it can get some pretty cool results, actually. So, I mean, certainly if you're thinking about working on any problem related to nanostructure carbon, like, this is a very good tool to use. And so maybe I'll use it myself soon. So does anybody have questions about either of the programs? Okay. If you have other questions about the homework, I'll be happy to talk about it in office hours after this. And then also, like, I just wanted to remind everybody that we'll have spring break.